Alex. We are holding Cedric Bays and Alex Beckenline. Still talking about the story of Yaakov and the Malach, because we're talking about Yid Anosha. Pasuk says in Hosea, there's another Hosea summarizes in a pasuk and a half or so, the story of Yaakov fighting with the Malach. It's part of the Haftorah of Vayesei or Vayishlach, according to different minhagim. The pasuk says, Vayoser Malach Vayuchal, he prevailed over the Malach, and he fought with the Malach, Vayuchal, and he was able to be successful. Bocha Vayishchanim, hello. He cried and he pleaded with him. So the way the pasuk is phrased, all you have is well, that's what we have to figure out. You have a bunch of pronouns over there. You don't have who did what. In Yedea, minas asarim. Based on those sukim, you wouldn't be able to understand who prevailed over who. Who became the sar over who? Because you could understand it that it means that Yaakov became the sar over the Malach. But it could also mean that by Yosser al Malach, in other words, he was fighting with the Malach, and the Malach ended up prevailing over him. So which is true? But when you have the pasuk back in Parshas Vayishlach after the fight, when the Malach tells him that you prevailed over Elikim, Yaakov not the sar the Malach, it means that Yaakov became the sar, that Yaakov became the ruler over the Malach, not the other way around. Okay. Then when the pasuk continues, Bacha Vayishchanim Loi, the pasuk continues, he cried and pleaded with him. Eini Yedea Mi Bacha L'Mi. You wouldn't know from that who cried to who and who pleaded with who. Okay, he said, but on the other hand, so that's the thing. You could think maybe it means that Yaakov won the fight, fine. But on the other hand, he was made to limp. His Yid Anosha was damaged. Therefore, he's crying from pain. No. Kru Oma Vayoma Shalcheini. But when the pasuk says, again, back in Vayishlach, when it says that the Malach says to him, let me go, because ki ola ashachar, because the morning came, as we said yesterday, have you ever Malach bacha leYaakov? It means the Malach cried and pleaded with Yaakov to let him go.
Crying?
Crying. And then, I don't know how a Malach can cry. How can a Malach fight either? I mean, the same way as a Malach can be mislabish in a human body and fight, the same way he can be mislabish in a human body and cry. And he's pleading with Yaakov to let him go, and Yaakov tells him, you can't go until you give me a bracha. Then the pasuk says, "Ki sarisa imalekim ve'imanoshim." So the pasuk continues that Malach tells him that you've fought with, and you've sarisa is also the Russian sow. You became a ruler, imalekim ve'imanoshim, over elekim, which means in context, elekim means a godly creature, meaning a Malach, and with people. So, but Omar Rabba remez ramadlo. It means the Malach is also giving him a remez. Shasidim shnei sorim lotis mimenu. That in the future there will be two great sorim, two great princes who descend from Yaakov. That's the Kisarisa. Rosh Goyla Shav Bavel, but Nasi Shav Eretz Yisrael. There's going to be the Rosh Golusa in Bavel. He's called the Imanoshim, Rashi says, because he has temporal power. He has the Jewish people in Bavel accept him as the ruler, and the kings of Bavel. The kings of Bavel considered him an important minister. And then, and the Nasi in Eretz Yisrael is called Imelekim, because the Nasiim in Eretz Yisrael have smicha, and they're entitled to give others smicha. And we know in many places, in Tukim, where Dayanim with smicha are called Elekim, Adr Elekim Yavid Varshneim.
But the Eibishter gave a bracha to Yaakov to have much more than two descendants.
No, then he's going to have two, in each generation, there's going to be two prominent descendants.
Oh, in each generation.
No, we don't mean, in other words, that throughout history. We mean that throughout generations to come, there's going to be the Resh Galusa in Babel, and there's going to be the Nasi in Eretz Yisrael, and those are the Sarisa in other generations. In every generation, well, up to a certain point. Yeah, I mean, nowadays we don't have either, but whatever. There's going to be a period when you have the two Sarim over there, for one in Eretz Yisrael and one in Babel. That's represented by Imalekim ve'imanoshim. It's Sarisa, that you have rulers coming out of you. If one of those rulers is Imalekim, is the one in Eretz Yisrael, who's on the level of called Elikim, because he has smicha, and the other one, ve'imanoshim, is the Resh Galusa in Bava.
What about all the kings?
What about all the kings? We're talking about in the later period, when you have kings, you don't want to have two of them, because you don't want to have two, it's not a bracha to have two kings who oppose each other, but when you have, like this, when you have Jews living in Eretz Yisrael and Jews living in Bavel, then that's a bracha that each one of them has a leader that rules over them, and that each one of them has a ruler over them that has certain powers. Okay. On the other hand, Mikan Ramaz Legolus, but it also means, on the other hand, the Malach thereby is also giving him a remez that there's going to be a Golus, because that's why you need a Resh Golusa. Okay.
That's not such good news.
Well, fine, but we're not saying it's all good news. But he's telling him that you should know, even when you're in Golos, and after all, remember, I was mentioning yesterday, the whole point of the story of the attack by the Malach, the fight with the Malach, and the Gid Anoshe and everything, is that the Jewish people are going to have a very hard time of it in Golos, and there are going to be times when they're limping and when they're damaged and whatever. But after all, the Malach is telling him, despite all that, despite all the limping, despite all the damage, nevertheless, Kisarise Malachim Veim Anoshim, you still earn that you're going to have great descendants. When did the Eibishter himself tell him about Golos? When did the Eibishter tell him that there was going to be Golos?
Oh, Golos. No, yeah. Not Golos.
No, that he's going to have descendants, that he's going to have a Jewish people descended from him. Fine. The Malach is stressing, in particular, you're going to have Shnei Sarim. Okay, so let's go on. Speaking of Sarim, of the Jewish people, so you have in a different pasuk, which we're going to darish in a similar way. In Parshas Vayeshev, you have the stories over there, you have the dreams over there of the Sara Mashkim and Sara Oikim, which Yosef is asked to interpret. And the Sara Mashkim's dream has a whole bunch of details. He sees a grapevine over Geffen Shlosha Sarigim. And then he sees on it three branches. Now, fine, in context of the three branches, Yosef tells him represents 3 days, then 3 days is going to be Pare's birthday, and he's going to release you from jail, et cetera, et cetera. But the point is, we douse in something else from it also. Omer Chiba Abba Omer Rab, Elu Gimel Sore Geim Hayotim Yisrael B'Choldovado. The word Sarigim literally means branches, but we douse in it as Sore Geim, princes who are proud, meaning Rashi says, Ashirim Akrovim L'Malchus, who are rich and who have connections with the government.
Geim
means Meloshin proud, not proud as in their big shot. Meloshin goyga, like they're very highly placed, they're very rich and they're very powerful, and they have the ear of the government. Hayotim Yisrael, that come out of the Jewish people, behold Dervader, in every generation, you always have such people. Sometimes in some periods of Jewish history, two of those people are going to be here, meaning in outside Eretz Yisrael, in Golos, and one is going to be in Eretz Yisrael. Sometimes the other way around, sometimes two of them are going to be in Eretz Yisrael, and one somewhere else in the world. So when he said this, So when Rabbah says that Yehibu Rabbanan Einayhu, the Chachamim put their eyes on, and they gave a look over at Rabbana Ukva, Rabbana Nechemya, Bnei Brate de Rab. They looked over at Rabbana Ukva and Rabbana Nechemya, who were the grandchildren of Rab, and they're descendants of Yaakov, of course. The whole Jewish people are descendants of Yaakov, but the point is, they are the two Sarei Geim in Chutzlaret at that point in history. Rabbana, in general, in Shas, the title Rabbana is reserved for people from the Reish Golos' family. So this Rabbana Ukva and Rabbana Nechemya, it so happens they're grandsons of Rav, but apparently they were connected with, they themselves may have been Rashi Golosa, or they were connected with the family at least, and therefore they're exactly that. They're rich, they're powerful, and they have the ear of the government. So at that point, when Rabbah said this, and the Chachamim looked over at Rabbana Ukva and Rabbana Nechemya, there you go. Now we can identify who are the two Sarei Geim and Chutz La'aretz in our generation. And then there's one in Eretz Yisrael who we don't. Okay. Rava says a different explanation of the Shlosha Sarigim. Eila Shlosha Sarei Goyim. Rather, the word Sarigim, he translates not as related to Sarei Geim, but proud or highly placed Sarim, but rather Sarei Goyim. Sorim of the Goyim, Shemalamdim Tzchus, HaYisrael, V'chol Dovader, who stick up for the Jewish people and defend them in every generation. Rashi says we're talking about Malochim of the nations. We know that the nations of the world have, each one has a Sar, Lamaila. So in every generation, Rava is saying, you have three of them who are Malamdim Tzchus on the Jewish people.
That's the design
of Hashem, that there should always be defenders for them, Lamaila. Rabbeinu Gershom says we're not necessarily just talking about Malachim. He says we may be talking about Pashut, you have good Goyim in every generation. And he gives an example. For example, in Rav's times, there was a guy named Adar Khan, who was a king or a prince or something of Persia, and he was a good Adar Khan, or Artavon, or whatever. There's different stories of the name exactly, but whatever. He was the ruler, or if not the ruler, then pretty close to it, of Persia, and he was very friendly with Rav and helped him out and whatever. So that's an example of one of the three Sarei Geim in that generation, three Sarei Goyim, rather. In that Tanya. So now we learn in a braisa. So we're going to talk a little more. Let's talk a little more about this dream of the Saramashkim. Now, again, in context, of course, you know, the Saramashkim has his dream, and Yosef tells him that it means that in 3 days you're going to be getting out of jail, etc. But first of all, we have to. What's bothering the Gemara is, first of all, why are there so many details in the dream? The Saramashkim goes on over there. He says that I saw a vine, and on the vine there were three branches, and it was blossoming and producing flowers and grapes, and then I took the grapes and squeezed them into Pare's cup. If all it was is just that it's a dream, just to tell him that in 3 days he's getting out of jail, all he has to see is I saw in a dream. All the pasuk has to tell us he saw a dream, that in his dream he's squeezing out grapes from a cup from a vine into Pare's cup, or just that he's serving Pare the cup or whatever. The fact that there are all the details means there's more significance there than that. Plus, also, I've seen an explanation also that Yosef explained that it's a positive dream, and it means the guy's getting out of jail in 3 days. Part of it is because Yosef saw that in that dream, as the Gemara is going to explain now, there are allusions to the future history of the Jewish people, to good things about the Jewish people, and therefore he realized if Hashem sent such a dream for the Saramashkim, then it means that he showed the reason why he's doing that is because it must be good things are happening to him, and therefore Hashem sent him a dream that has good allusions for the Jewish people.
You can say the same for the
Saramashkim
in the other sense.
Why? The Saramashkim's dream has nothing to do necessarily with the history of the Jewish people. The Gemara is going to establish now that all the details in the Saramashkim's dream are telling something about the Jewish people, as opposed to the Saramashkim's dream, not necessarily. Okay, so Tanya, Rabbi Eliezer, you're asking about the details in his dream. There's not really that much detail. All he says is he has three baskets on his head, and the birds are eating. Right, three because of 3 days. The important thing is the 3 days.
The three branches, it could be the three temples.
That's what the Gemara is going to talk about, a number of possibilities, what the three are. But the point is not just the three branches. The point is we have to understand why in the Saramashkim's dream is it important to know that it was blossoming and produced flowers and then produced grapes and so forth. Why not just, he saw a grapevine with three branches and he squeezed out the grapes, finished. Tanya, Rabbi Eliezer, Gefen Zeh Olam, the vine refers to the world as a whole. Shloisha Sarigim Zavram Yitzchak Yaakov, the three branches refer to the three others. The Hichifairachas also means, so then when it says that it was blossoming and produced flowers, that refers to the Imahos. So Rashi explains that you have the main body of the vine is made up of branches, and then you have the flowers are like attached to them. They're like secondary care. So like the Imahos are attached to the others. And then when it says that it ripened, that the cluster is ripe, were carrying ripe grapes, that refers to the Shvatim. So Rabbi Yeshua says to Rabbi Eliezer, what's the point of such a dream? You don't show a person a dream what already happened. Why would he have to be shown a portent of what already happened? The whole point is you show somebody what's yet to happen. Now, yes, Marashah points out, of course, we know that the Gemara tells us in Bracha, the person usually dreams about by night what he's thinking about by day. But the point is Hashem takes what the person is thinking about by day and uses that where it's appropriate, where Hashem decides to show him about the future. Then he shows him using what he already had and what he already was thinking about, and Hashem shows him what's going to happen in the future. So what's the point of a dream where all of the things in it already happened? Right. Ella, so no, Rabbi Yeshua says that's not the explanation. Gefen zet Torah, rather the grapevine refers to the Torah. Shloisha sarigim eva Moshe Aaron ba'aron and Miriam, the three branches. No, when Yosef is talking with the Saramashkim, this is all in the future. The Torah hasn't been given yet. There's no Moshe Aaron and Miriam yet. Those are hundreds of years in the future.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, of course. We're not talking about now. We're talking about the time when the Saramashkim had the dream. It's Miriam, the three leaders of the Jewish people by Yitzhak Mitzrayim. The Hichifairachas also Mitzah, when it says that it was blossoming and producing flowers, Elus Sanhedrin, that refers to the members of the Sanhedrin. Hivshilu Ashkelesea Anovim, when it says that ripened into grapes, Elu Asadikim Shemachol Dervader, that's the Sadikim in every generation. So therefore, it's foretelling that there's going to be, that the Jewish people are going to merit these things in the future. Okay. Amar Ram Gamliel. Okay, Amar Ram Gamliel. No, but the point is, in other words, That's fine. But now Yosef is seeing in the Sana Mashkim's dream and in all the details that he's being told, we see that it's actually, this is starting to happen now. The Sana Mashkim, the point is, of the number of the Mokoshim explained, the idea is the Sana Mashkim's dream is, well, Yosef being in jail and then the Sana Mashkim's dream is the beginning stages of Golos Mitzrayim. So Yosef is being shown, yes, Golos Mitzrayim is going to be starting now. However, there's going to be great things coming out of it. There's going to be a Torah, there's going to be Moshe, Aaron, and Miriam, etc. So therefore, he's being shown, in other words, that it's not just the Jewish people are going to wind up in Mitzrayim, and then they're going to have a very hard time of it. You should know the result of all of that is going to be great things. Okay. Amar Rav Gamliel, Adayin Tzrichin Onu L'Mudoi. However, Rav Gamliel says, neither of these explanations is really that satisfactory. We still need what the Mudoi says. The Mudoi is Rav Elazar HaMudoi. HaMudoi means it came from the city of Modi'in. So we still need...
In Israel,
yeah. So Rav Gamliel says, we still need to hear what the Mudoi says. Because the Rav Elazar HaMudoi explains that all the details in the dream are all talking about in one place. In other words, we're not talking about different aspects of Jewish history. They all have very close connections with each other. Namely, Rav Elazar HaMudoi, and Geffen Zeh Yerushalayim, the great Brian refers to Yerushalayim, Shloshes Terigim Zeh Mikdash Melech L'Kohen Gadol, the three branches are the three major aspects of Jewish society that's going to be in Yerushalayim, the three primary things that you have in Yerushalayim, the Beit HaMikdash itself, the king and the Kohen Gadol. They're the three ways, basically, in which the Jewish people relate to Hashem. So then when the prophet continues, it's blossoming and producing flowers. This refers to the young Kohanim who serve in the Beis HaMikdash. So the Pirchei Kohanim means literally the blossoms of the Kohanim. So they're blossoming forth like the blossoms of a grapevine. If Shilo Ashkeloseh, I'm Melvin, when it finishes off, that it ripened into grapes. Elam Nesachim, this refers to the Nesachim that those Pirchei Kohanim are going to pour on the Mizbeach. So that's an advantage of Rav Elazar HaMudoi's explanation that all the different parts of it cohere together. They all cohere together. They're all talking about the Avodah in the Beis HaMikdash. It might also be also, I mean, the reason why we're singling out Mikdash Melech Kohen Gadol is because specifically the king and the Kohen Gadol specifically play roles. You're asking why not the Nevi'im, for example, because the king and the Kohen Gadol specifically play roles with the Beit HaMikdash. The king is the one who financed the whole thing in the first place, or not financed, maybe all the Jewish people gave money towards it, but the David and afterwards Shlomo are the ones who made it happen with executive power. They're also the ones in later generations. We have just now that Torah of Parshas Shkalim, that they're the ones who renovate the Beis HaMikdash, who arrange to get the Beis HaMikdash renovated when it's the time, etc. And the Kohen Gadol, obviously, is the one in charge of everything in the Beis HaMikdash. Okay. Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, Mukim Lod Matonis. Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi has another explanation of the details of the dream. He explains that they're referring to the gifts that Hashem gave the Jewish people in the Midbar. The Amr Rabbi Shurban Levi, Geffen Zu Torah, the grapevine refers to the Torah, Shlosha Sarigim Zeh Be'er Amud Anon Uman, the three branches of the three...
I'm sorry to interrupt you. Some places, Torah is called mine. In some places, it's called Shemen. And here
yes,
it's called Geffen.
In fact, I believe you have, in one place or another, the Torah is compared to each of the Shiva Mashkim. We know we have seven things that are considered liquids as far as Hilchos Tumah B'Tahara. I believe we find places where the Torah is compared to each one of them because different aspects of the Torah is also compared to bread. The Torah is compared to a lot of different things because different aspects of Torah relate to different things. Mayim is the fact that it comes down from Chokhmah Tzeirus HaKadosh Baruch Hu into our world, into something that we can comprehend. It's like wine, especially soda satorah, like wine that intoxicate a person and help bring out their inner personality. It's like oil that penetrates. It's like milk that nourishes a baby, etc. Yeah. So over here we're comparing the Torah to we're talking about the wine aspect of Torah.
Like water that you cannot live without it.
Without too, yeah. Yeah. Okay. So Shloshes Terigim Zeh Be'er Amud Anon Uman, the three branches are the three gifts that Hashem gave the Jewish people in the Midbar. There's the well of Miriam, there's the pillar of cloud that went in front of them to show them the way, and the Mon, which the Gemara tells us elsewhere, were in the schus of Moshe, Aaron, and Miriam, respectively, the Be'er from Miriam, the Mon from Moshe, and the cloud from Aaron. Also need. So then when it continues that it blossomed and it produced flowers, Elo HaBikurim, That refers to the Bikurim, that eventually after that, so first Hashem gave them these gifts in the Midbar, so they'd be able, they'd be comfortable and able to travel, and then afterwards Hashem brings them into a fruitful and rich land from which they bring Bikurim. And then Bikurim are brought, where the, you designate them as Bikurim when they first blossom, when they first start growing, and then later on you bring them, they're the first fruit. So therefore they can be symbolized by the flowers growing on them, by the flowers and blossoms growing. And Hibshilu Ashkelos, they are Novim, Elu Nesachim, then like Rabbi Elazar Amadori had said that the ripened grapes refer to the Nesachim that are poured on the Mizeach. Okay. Rabbi Yumi Abba, Hibshilu, Meloshin Boshel, Hibshilu, Meloshin Right. Okay. Rabbi Yumi Abba Abba, here's another explanation. Let's go into details. Gesen Elu Yisrael, the grapevine refers to the Jewish people in, collectively. And he, unlike all the other ones, he's going to bring a pasuk to illustrate each one. Geffen Elu Yisrael, v'chein hu omer geffen mitzrayim tasiya. We find, in fact, a pasuk where the Jewish people are called a grapevine, and till them it says, you, Hashem, moved a vine from Mitzrayim and brought it to Eretz Yisrael, representing the Jewish people. Shlosha Tzarigim Elu Shlosha Regolim Shi Yisrael Olim Behen B'chol Shana V'shana. The three branches of the Shlosh Regolim, when the Jewish people go up to the Olu Regol, to the Beit Mikdash. Then when it continues that it blossoms, so he actually breaks up. Everybody else was doing the hichifarachas olta mitzah as one thing, and explaining that it symbolizes one thing. But Rabbi Yirmi Abba Abba is breaking it up into two, the hichifarachas and olta mitzah. They're two separate things. Rashi in a couple of different places explains. Well, perach and mitzah are both blossoms and flowers, but Rashi talks about I think a connection with Aaron's staff by Yotze Perach by Yotze Tzitz. So Rashi talks about over there that by Yotze Perach is the first stage of the flowers, and then by Yotze Tzitz is the later stage. Anyway, the point is that so he breaks it up. The hichaferachas means he also nitsa. It says over here also nitsa, but Hagos Habach takes it out because also nitsa he's gonna douse in that separately soon. So that means he gears man and shows Yisrael liferes v'lirbos. It's symbolizing that now when the Jewish people are in Mitzrayim is the time that the Jewish people should start multiplying and being fruitful. In other words, he's douse in kiparachas meloshin pora. So in other words, that even while the Jewish people are in Mitzrayim, it's time for them to start multiplying.
Under the harshest conditions.
In fact, one of the Farshim on Cholin called Lev Aryeh explains. Now, on the face of it, we're talking on the face of it. The rest of the explanation over here is talking about what's going on at the time of Gaula. So why over here? I mean, the Peru of Wu, the Poru of Ayushatsu, et cetera, happened much earlier. So he explains, because we know the Medrash says, why indeed did the Jewish people spend only 210 years in Mitzrayim, when on the face of it, Hashem had promised Abraham that they're going to be 400 years, Be'eretz Lo Lahem. And one explanation the Medrash says is because since the Jewish people multiplied so much in Mitzrayim, in terms of man hours, they accomplished 400 years worth of Galus, even though they were there only 210 calendar years. So therefore, that's why the Gemara is stressing that point of it. He was Giyas Manan Shobnei Yisrael Lifris Velubris, because that will make the Geula come much faster.
Reminds me of Giyas Manku.
Yeah, yeah.
But
yeah.
It could have been also that Hashem had a certain degree of Rahmanin.
There's many reasons why there was only 210 years. I mean, we say in that God, Chishev Es HaKeis Lachas, that Hashem had Rahmanin and counted it from when Yitzchak was born. There's many, many reasons given why. But one reason, which the Midrashim say, is because since there were so many Jews over there, that in terms of man hours, yeah. Okay. Anyway, continuing. There's many, many reasons. Okay. Also neat. So then the next part of the pasuk continues that the blossoms are coming up. In other words, the blossoms themselves are growing, meaning he gives man and show Yisrael ligoil. It's time for the Jewish people to be redeemed from Mitzrayim.
Yes.
Where do you get nitsa? Yes, meloshin nesach. V'chein hu omer v'yeiz nitzchom abugodai v'chom malbushai eg olti. You have a pasuk in Yeshaya that says that when Hashem punishes the nations for mistreating the Jewish people, so the yeiz nitzchom abugodai, their nesach, meaning their blood, will squirt on my clothing, Hashem says, so to speak, v'chom malbushai eg olti, and all of my clothes I'll make filthy. In other words, that Hashem, this is Hashem is saying, so to speak, you have a pasuk, you have pasukim in Yeshaya over there, where Hashem appears as, so to speak, a warrior with bloodied clothing, and like people are asking him, where are you coming from? And he says, I'm coming from Edom, where I've just punished all the goyim, and their blood has squirted all over my clothes, etc., in order to save the Jewish people. So here also, so we see that saving the Jewish people and punishing their oppressors can be expressed with the word netzach. And therefore, also nitzah is, yeah. The word agolti means that brings on the side over here from Marshall, it's Meloshin Megual, it means filthy. And in various places, Siddurth, it also talks about the deeper idea that it's also Meloshin Geula.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, but they, okay. Hivshilu Ashkelet, yeah.
Gaalti Vashan.
The word Gaal can also be Meloshin Mius, yeah. Yeah. Then when it finishes off, that the cluster is ripened and produced grapes, means he gears mana shom Mitzrayim lishtoth koi satar eva. Means it's time for Mitzrayim to drink the cup of bitterness, the cup of staggering. You know, throughout Tanakh, you have a metaphor. Whenever Hashem is punishing a nation, it always describes that they're drinking the cup, they're drinking the numbing cup, like they, so to speak, like you drink a cup of wine and you become disoriented. So like Hashem does that, so to speak, and then the goyim become completely confused and disoriented and destroyed. Tareva, Meloshin Ra'al. In modern Hebrew, Ra'al means poison, but in Tanakh, Ra'al means more like staggering and being confused and everything. Okay, Vahainu de Omar Rava, and this is like what Rava said, Shloisha Koisa Samuris for Mitzrayim Lama. Why is it that three times Kois by Mitzrayim, namely in the Saramashkin dream, you have, he mentions three times over there, the word Kois Paro. So why three times? It represents, he's thinking, he's just telling over his dream, and Yosef is interpreting it. But it has a deeper meaning, since it's recorded in the Torah. Echot sheshosa b'mei Moshe, it means that one time Mitzrayim drank this cup of numbing in the times of Moshe Rabbeinu, with the Makkos. The echot sheshosa b'mei Paro Nechoi, a second one they were made to drink in the times of Paro Nechoi, which is the time when Nebuchadnezzar invaded and conquered Mitzrayim and took them all the way into Golos. It's in our Torah of Va'era and Bo'i, Shaya and Yirmiyah. Not Yeshaya, Yumiya, and Yechezkel say divorce about it. Yeah, we're talking hundreds of years later, but throughout history, in other words. The Echad Shasida Lishtes and Kola Ovdi Kachavim. And a third one that Mitzrayim is going to drink along with all the other nations that harm the Jewish people. So that's why three cups. So we see, in other words, that this Hibshilu Ashkele Seah Anovim relates to this idea of Mitzrayim having to drink this cup, this numbing cup of wine, so to speak.
What is the purpose of numbing
them? The point is, in other words, the simple meaning is, in other words, that it's a metaphor for Hashem punishing a nation by giving them a cup to drink, where therefore they become disoriented and numb, and like they don't know what to do, and therefore they end up getting destroyed. Amalei Rav Abba, Rav Yumi Abba Abba, so Rav Abba tells Rav Yumi Abba Abba, not necessarily were they related, maybe they were, I don't know, maybe it was his father, I don't know, Ki Dorish Lahu Rav Lahani Kroi Ba'agadja, you should know, when Rav was explaining these psukim, when he was teaching Agadja, Kavasach Dorish Lahu, he followed your explanation that we said that the grapevine refers to the Jewish people, and the Shlosh HaSarigim are the Shalosh Regalim, etc. So what's the point? What's the point of that Rav specifically picked Rabbi Yumi Abba Abba's explanation? So there's a sicha where the Rebbe talks about the idea, and the sicha from Lama Tess, I think, where the Rebbe talks, no, not from Lama, no, from Chavav, actually, there's a sicha from Vayesha Chavav, where the Rebbe talks about like this. Later on, in a couple of weeks, says Hashem, we're going to learn that Rav's mission in life was to take places that were not a Mokum Torah and turn them into a Mokum Torah. He accomplished that in various places in Bavel. So therefore, so his big thing is showing how the advantage that's accrued from being in Golos, the advantage that you're able to accomplish while in Golos. So therefore, he picked specifically Rabbi Yumi Abba Abba's explanation, which reflects this idea that in Golos, the Jewish people are multiplying, and that Hashem takes us out of Golos. And then afterwards, after talking about the Geula of the Jewish people, okay, then you have to talk about that the Goyim drink the numbing cup of wine, where actually the Rebbe puts a bit of a positive spin on it, it seems, that it is a metaphor for punishment, but it's more a metaphor for like kind of cleaning them up from
saying that the Jewish people could have not accomplished the same thing in Eretz Israel rather than in Galus.
Not necessarily we could have. I mean, Hashem planned the world, and Hashem decided the Jewish people need to have a stint in Galus. And yeah, part of the idea is that had the Jewish people remained in Eretz Israel the whole time and not gone through the Kurat Barzel, the purifying furnace of Mitzrayim, then no, not necessarily would we have had all these great advantages. And the same thing
as well.
Same, such as what we're saying, all the ones that Rabbi Yumi Abba mentioned. but also, I mean, the same is true as far as our current dollars. I mean, put it this way. You also have to distinguish between, you know, there's a way that this is a thread. You can learn many sikhas where the Rebbe develops such ideas that you have, there's the original plan, and then there's the modified plan, which it didn't have to be that way originally, but once it's done, then you have advantages of it that you wouldn't have had, at least not in the state, to the same extent, had the original plan been followed. You have that already with the Chet Tadaf, you have it with the Edel, you have it with many other watershed moments in Jewish history. For example, let's say as far as the Golos, it could have happened, the Jewish people had done the right thing in Shlomo HaMelech's times, and everybody is streaming towards Eretz Yisrael, and that is the ideal way it should have been, and that's the way it'll have been in the Moshiach Mashiach. That's the way it will be, rather, the Moshiach Mashiach. In the event, it didn't happen like that in Jewish history, so instead we wound up having to go into Golos, but meanwhile, in Golos, there is the tremendous amount of suffering and the tremendous amount of everything that we went through. But on the other hand, there are things that were accomplished that at least on the surface wouldn't have been accomplished in the same way had it not been for that. So here it's the same kind of thing that Rav is saying. That's why he's using Rav Yirmiyahu Ba'am. Because, I mean, obviously Hashem is Kol Yochel, but the way we look at it, the way that we perceive it, is that we had to go through these experiences in order to have these milos. Golos is not just a I'm talking about the Rebbe talks about in many places where you could open almost any sikha and look at a sikha, for example, and see about it. That the Golos is not just a punishment. It is mipnei chateinu golunim arseinu, but there's certain advantages, there's certain profits that were made from it that would not necessarily have been made in the same way without that. Whatever, we'll talk about it more later. We have to continue the Gemara over here. But the point is that Rebbe says in the Sicha and Chavav that that's why Rav preferred Rabbi Yirmiyahu Ba'aba's explanation, because it spoke to his own Derech HaVavoda, which is to go into the Golos and transform it from within, which is what he accomplished in Bavel and in other places.
Transform
the places in Golos, places where, for example, there were Amei Aretz, and transform them into places of Torah.
So
therefore, similar to what we're saying over here, that you have the Jewish people were in Mitzrayim, and then they multiply over there, and then they're redeemed from there, and afterwards Hashem deals with there was cleaning up what the Goyim did.
It seems that rather than transform the Galus, at least to the same extent, we were transformed by the Galus.
We were transformed by it, but we also transformed it. You're familiar, I'm sure, with what it talks about, that we took out 202 of the 288 sparks of Kedusha out of Mitzrayim. That's a transformation of Mitzrayim.
We don't deny that.
Okay, so then that's the point. That's the point we're getting at. In other words, right now, let's continue. You want to talk bring about it later. We'll bring about it later. But right now, let's continue. The point is that there is one way of looking at Golos is basically it's wholly negative. But there's also a way of looking at it, despite the fact, yes, we want out of it. We demand we want Mashiach now, etc. We also do have to realize that there are certain advantages that the Jewish people have gotten during the time of Golos. We have to realize Hashem didn't just put us into Golos strictly as a punishment, strictly because he wants Chas V'Shalom to wash his hands of us, but also so that we can accomplish something over here. That's Menashe versus Ephraim, a whole sikha about Yosef versus Yaakov's perspectives on it. We can talk about that later, but anyway, let's continue.
Yeah. Even though we didn't really need to go through that.
In other words, that's the point. In principle, it shouldn't have happened that we had to go through it, but Hashem makes plans for all the different contingencies, basically. Yeah. Okay, let's go on. Omer of Shimon ben Lakish. Since we mentioned the Jewish people are like a vine, so let's analyze that metaphor a little bit. Umozu kegefen nimshala. This nation, the Jewish people, are like a vine. Zmoris shabar elabalabatim. The branches in it are like the balabatim, because everything grows from the branches. In the same way, the balabatim do gemilas chesed, and they support the poor, and they also, Rashi says, they give money to the government on behalf of the poorer Jewish people, whether in taxes or bribes or whatever, and that way they keep the Jewish people going and going. So they're like the branches. The clusters of grapes are like the Tumen HaChachamim, which is the ultimate purpose of the vine. The leaves of the grapevine, which they withstand the wind, they protect the clusters of grapes from getting damaged by the wind and the sun and whatever. So therefore, they represent the Amei Ha'aretz, Elu Amei Ha'aretz, because the Amei Ha'aretz are the ones they plow and plant and harvest and whatever, and the Tamar Chachamim are able to eat what they provide. It's funny, actually, by the way, the Alter Rebbe talks about Igeres Chavav in Tanya. The Alter Rebbe starts that Igeres by quoting a long piece from the Zohar about how it'll be different, Limos HaMashiach, the relationship between the Talmud Chacham and the Amei Ha'aretz. And then the Alter Rebbe brings in that, you know, in one part of that passage is that nowadays the Talmud Chachamim have to eat from what the Amei Ha'aretz provide them, sort of like the way you prepare during the week and you eat on Shabbos. But La'asid Lave, it won't be that way. And the Alter Rebbe asked, one of the many questions that the Alter Rebbe starts the Igeres with is, what are you talking about? The Talmud Chacham didn't have to rely on the Amei Ha'aretz for their food. They had their own fields and vineyards and whatever. So I haven't seen a good explanation of how that fits with our Gemara and with what Rashi's saying over here. The only thing I can think of is the Alter Rebbe says specifically during the time of the Bais Sheni, it was like that. So maybe our Gemara is talking about after the Churban.
If they're on field, someone had to plow them.
Fine, many times the Talmud Chacham did that themselves, but even if not, whatever. Yeah, but so it could be, maybe that's one way of reconciling it. They had fields, but they had the Amei Ha'aretz working for them. Still, though, that wouldn't fit with what the Alter Rebbe is asking about, that in that case, it's still an obvious thing. The Talmud Chacham still require the Amei Ha'aretz for their basic needs. So therefore, I think it's more that the Alter Rebbe is talking about, he says, so it's not talking about during the time of the Second Beit Mikdash, or Gemara maybe is talking after the Churban. So then it was less common for Talmud Chacham to be able to afford fields and vineyards and whatever of their own, and therefore, of necessity, they had to buy from the Amei Ha'aretz. Okay, anyway. Knoknes, Shabbat, and then you have a grapevine also has tendrils, these little things, these little curly things that stick out from the branches, which when you put a vine by a trellis, they use that to climb up. They're called, in Hebrew, they're called knoknes. In English, they're called tendrils.
Tendrils.
Elu rekonin shabistro, those refer to the empty people among the Jewish people. In and of themselves, they're not really worth anything, but they, after all, they're still part of the people. Behind the shochem, in other words, they don't have mitzvahs and they don't have Torah. They don't seem to have any. Okay, but that's new, and you have other gemaras that say that afilu rekonin shibachom lay mitzvahs kerimen. So over here also, you have okay. So that's what we're saying. On the other hand, on the surface they're rekonim, but on the other hand, they have a purpose. They're knoshnos, just like a grapevine has. V'hainu d'sholcho mitam, this explains what it means. They sent one time a message from Eretz Yisrael to Bavel, L'boi rachnim iskalaya al alaya, the clusters of grapes, meaning the Shemir Chachamim, should daven for Rachmanos on behalf of the leaves, which we said means the Amei Ha'aretz. D'omale, alaya lo miskayim and iskalaya, because if it's not for the leaves, then the clusters of grapes won't be able to continue existing. In other words, the Shemir Chachamim have to rely on the Amei Ha'aretz for their food, so therefore daven on their behalf. So the whole Jewish people are interdependent. That's okay. Fine. Let's talk about another pasuk. Iskalaya means Meloshin Ashkolos. It's the Aramaic word for clusters of grapes. Okay. Here's another metaphor for the Jewish people. You have like this. The pasuk in Hosea, the first couple of chapters of Hosea are a long extended metaphor comparing the relationship between Hashem and the Jewish people to a man and his unfaithful wife. So like Hashem took the Jewish people as his wife, and the Jewish people were over and over unfaithful to Hashem. You have the story over there at the beginning where Hashem tells Hosea to take an unfaithful wife. The Gemara tells us in Psachim that Hosea tells Hashem, so why bother? Just pick another nation instead. And Hashem tells Hosea to take this unfaithful wife, a harlot as a wife, and later he has two children of her, and then Hashem tells him, you should be divorcing her, and Hosea says, I can't, I love her, and Hashem says, no, and what are you thinking?
Hashem makes it, he finds
attached to her. Yeah, exactly. Okay. Anyway, anyway, so, the pasuk says over there in Hosea, v'ekreha li b'chamisha osir kosis. The whole pasuk goes like this, v'ekreha li, the Gemara is going to explain in a second that v'ekreha means I bought her for myself, b'chamisha osir kosis, with 15 silver pieces, and then the pasuk continues, v'chomer sa'odim v'lesech sa'odim, as well as a chomer and a lesech of barley. So the Gemara is going to douse in what each of these phrases means. First of all, in kira elaloshim mechira, the word kira is an expression of buying. Shenema, like you have a pasuk in Vayichi, b'kivri asher korisi li, that Yaakov says to Yosef, bury me in the grave that korisi for myself, and korisi means that I bought. Rashi mentions over there on the pasuk that Yaakov gave all the gold and silver that he had gotten some love on, etc., and gave it to Esau. It's called kira, yeah. In the Gemara, there's a Gemara in Rosh Hashanah. where Rabbi Akiva says that he actually visited, he one time visited a place where the regular word for selling is kira. So therefore,
instead of
mechira, right? Okay, so that's so when the pasuk says I bought her for myself, that's what it means. But karet holy means I bought her for myself.
Here means also keep buying.
Yeah, that's what we're saying. Bachamisha also, then it says I bought with 15. What so the in context is chamisha also cost 15 pieces of silver. But the Gemara is breaking it up. Zeh text above the Nissan. This refers to the 15th of Nissan. Shabbat nigalu yisroam mitzrayim. That's when the Jewish people were redeemed from Mitzrayim, and that's when Hashem, so to speak, bought us. Kesef Elu Tzadikim, when the Pasuk says that there was silver involved, silver refers to the Tzadikim. V'cheinu emet Srera Kesef Lokach B'yadu. We find the Pasuk in Mishlei where the Tzadikim are referred to as a bundle of silver. Rashi explains the context is over there in Mishlei, in Perek Zayin, you have a long metaphor about an Isha Zoyna who tries to trick a young man into being a Zana with her. And then and she said, and so and the Gemara in Sanhedrin explains that actually what it is among the meanings of that passage is it's talking about what happened when the nations of Ammon and Moab were trying to convince Nebuchadnezzar to go and destroy the Beit Mikdash and destroy Yerushalayim. So among other things, he's nervous about this. Remember, Nebuchadnezzar, the Gemara tells us over there in Sanhedrin, had been there when Sancheir's army is destroyed, so he's nervous about starting up with the Jewish people again. And they tell him, don't worry, Hashem took the bundle of silver in his hand. In other words, that the tzaddikim in the generation have all died out, and therefore you don't have to worry that the tzaddikim are going to daven and then take away the grain. Well, not all of the tzaddikim. You still have Yumi, you still have Yumiya, you still have Yechezkel, but they may have been right that there are a lot of them. Okay, anyway. So that's so kesef over here means the tzaddikim that Hashem took the Jewish people out of Mitzrayim in the schos of the tzaddikim.
So who said that?
So this is Ammon and Moab said that. And again, in the context, in the marshal over there, in the marshal over there in Mishlei, it's this Isha Zoyna is trying to convince this young man and saying, don't worry, my husband went away on a long trip. He's not coming back anytime soon. Anyway, the point
is,
well, in context over there, no, according to the metaphor that the Gemara explains in Sanhedrin, is actually it's Ammon and Moab trying to convince the Nebuchadnezzar to go and destroy the Beit Mikdash.
Why Ammon and Moab compared to each other?
Because I don't know why they're specific. Well, for one thing, they're where are they descended from in the first place? They're descended from two Zionists. They're descended from Lloyd's daughters, right? But okay, whatever. The point is that the Gemara explains it that yeah. Okay. Anyway. Okay. Then the pasuk continues that besides the 15 silver pieces, which he said 15 is the date of Yetzias Mitzrayim, and silver refers to the tzaddikim. So a chomer is a measurement that equals 30 saw. A lesach is half of that, 15 saw. So a chomer plus a lesach equals 45 saw of barley. This refers to the 45 tzaddikim that the world continues to exist in their zchus. In every generation, there's 45 such tzaddikim. The 36 hidden tzaddikim we often talk about. So here we're talking about those 45. So maybe 36 of them are hidden and 45 aren't. I don't know. Like I was going to say in a second that a bunch of them are hidden tzaddikim.
Oh, they're not the same?
Not necessarily the other. It could be that one group includes the other. I don't know. But there you go.
It has to be. I mean, yeah. You can say 36.
Could be. Yeah, it could be. All right. Anyway, so the point is, so 30 and 15 is 45. So 45 tzaddikim that the world stands in their zchus. There's also, I mean, there's different levels of tzaddikim also. You have, for example, there's a Gemara in Sukkah, which the Alter Rebbe quotes in Perek Yod of Tanya, that you have, you know, Bnei Aliyah are very, very few. On the other hand, a lesser degree of tzaddik Sheni Gomer, as the Alter Rebbe says. Bnei Aliyah, the Alter Rebbe explains over there. Well, it means tzaddikim Gemurim, it means a really high level of tzaddik, that they're avoiders purely L'Shem Shemayim, without any, not even because they want to come close to El, of course, but just because Hashem wants it. And also because they were the ones who are able to do the fullest job of being Mila things of the world to Kedusha. So Bnei Aliyah, they are more often. On the other hand, the Gemara says over there that you have a level of tzaddik, which Alter Rebbe identifies as the tzaddikim she'enim gemurim, then you have 18,000 of them sitting around the Shina and Gan Eden. So you have different levels of tzaddikim. So maybe the 36 are one level and the 45 are another. Okay, anyway. Okay, so you have 45 tzaddikim, yeah. The Eliyadeh, now why are they broken up into 30 and 15? So it means there's 30 in one part of the Jewish world and 15 in another part. The Eliyadeh im shloshim kan b'tesvav b'eretz Yisrael, the im shloshim b'eretz Yisrael b'tesvav kan. So what is it? Are 30 of them here in Bavel or anywhere else in the Jewish world and 15 in Eretz Yisrael? Or are there 30 in Eretz Yisrael and 15 here? Well, we know there's 30 and we know there's 15, but which one? Well, since now let's look at another pasuk in Zechariah. In Zechariah, you have another mussel over there that says that Hashem says that previously in this mussel you have Hashem describes over there how I have two sticks, like two different ways of running the world and treating the nations, and whatever, makol chovrim and makol noyam, the destructive stick and the pleasant stick and whatever. And then Hashem, then the pasuk continues that Hashem says that I broke my stick of noyam, that now I'm not going to have my covenant with the nations anymore. In other words, I'm not going to treat them so gently anymore. And then the pasuk says, so you have the next pasuk. Hashem says, give me my reward, 30 shkolim. The Gemara is going to quote that pasuk in a second. And then the next pasuk continues, I took the 30 silver pieces, and I threw them into the house of Hashem to the Yotzer. So the simple meaning of Yotzer means a power. But the Gemara is darshaning Yotzer meloshin Oitzer, a treasure. So when it says that you have 30 of them in Beis Hashem by the Oitzer, Heviyam is Shloshim Be'ot Tzitzov, a Tetzvav Kan. Putting that together with the Pasuk in Hosea yields that the 30 of these 45 tzaddikim are in Eretz Yisrael, and 15 of them are in Chutz La'aretz.
That makes sense.
Okay, fine. But we wouldn't have known that without the Pasuk in Zechariah.
Because it says
that the 30 kesef, which again, we said kesef before tzaddikim, that are based Hashem, Allah Yotze, meaning that they're in Eretz Yisrael. By the way, Marshall points out, first we were talking about a metaphor of tzaddikim as kesef, and then we switched to a metaphor of tzaddikim as barley. So what is it? Why are we switching metaphors? He says because silver refers to the tzaddikim as they are in their place, as they are in their place, during the good times of the Jewish people, and then barley refers to the times of Golos when the tzaddikim are scattered, like you scatter barley in order to grow more barley.
A bit paradoxical that you compare tzaddikim to kesef when the tzaddikim are so out of this world.
Okay, but nevertheless, they're like kesef.
So
the word, yeah, that's fine, but they still live in the world, and besides which, the word kesef is also related to the word kinichsef nichsafta. It means a yearning for a lakus. So therefore, it's a very appropriate metaphor for tzaddikim. But then Marshall explains that
that's... only go for kesef. You said the same thing with gold and other metals.
Gold is not kesef. So the word kesef, kinichsef nichsafti, is specifically silver. Fine. I mean, look, in Tanya and Perek Nun, the Alter Rebbe talks about, you have the avoda like kesef, and you have the avoda like zahav. Fine, but the avoda of your run-of-the-mill tzaddik, so to speak, is the avoda of kesef. Okay, anyway, the point is, Marshall says that so you have kesef as a metaphor for tzaddikim, like when they're in their place, and sa'orim, barley, is a metaphor for the tzaddikim when they're being scattered hither and yon, like you scatter barley when you plant it. Okay, fine. Omer Abaya says, as far as those 15 tzaddikim that are in Golos, that are outside of Israel, Burubayu Mishtakti the Beit Knishti the Tusi Afsa. Most of them can be found in the shul of Tusi Afsa. Tusi Afsa, Rashi explains, means We didn't. Afsa, Rashi explains, is Yitzia. It means like a balcony or an extra wing of a building or whatever. So apparently what it is the various Mephoshim explains, you had a shul someplace in Babel that was like it was like an out of the way shul. It was like under the balcony or something, like, so like you think of like under the bleachers in 770 or something, you know, like not the place where people stick out, like, you know, then that's the place where like you have the hidden tzaddikim hang out over there, and they are the 15 tzaddikim, and most of them you can find over there. So this also fits with what it says also in those psukim in Zechariah. Va'oimer aleihem. So the pasuk says over there, I said to them, meaning Hashem metaphorically says to the nations, im tov be'enechem havu schori, if it's good in your eyes, then give me my reward, which Rashi explains, means in other words, you have the tzaddikim who are among you, that in your schos, you're getting reward for them living among you. Give them back to me. Because in other words, Hashem says Hashem to the nations, in other words, like you don't deserve to have such people among you. The imloi chadolu, and if you don't agree, then you can hold back. And they weighed out my pay, 30 silver coins, so that's the 30 tzaddikim that we're talking about. Like Hashem says, in other words, they don't belong among you. If anything, they belong in Eretz Yisrael. So therefore,
So
30 is outside of Eretz Yisrael. No, so the 30 are in it, maybe at one point they were outside, but then they returned to Eretz Yisrael. Okay, Rashi explains that what it means is, in other words, that we're saying, Rashi seems to be explaining that this drasha disagrees with the previous one. Before we were saying that the 30, no, that we're talking about, but before we were assuming that the 45 tzaddikim we're talking about are all among the Jewish people. Now we're saying that Hashem originally intended that there should be a certain number of tzaddik among the goyim, but they don't deserve it. So therefore, Hashem says, I'm taking that away from you and making that the 30 tzaddikim from now on will be among the Jewish people and not among the goyim.
In Eretz Yisrael?
Maybe, well, we said before in Eretz Yisrael, but the point to be fine. But the point is, in other words, that Hashem originally intended that there should be a certain number of tzaddikim among the goyim in every generation, but then Hashem is saying you don't deserve it, and therefore I'm taking that privilege back.
So
he took all the tzaddikim, out of the goyim. In other words, you don't have tzaddikim among the goyim.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. Okay, that you don't have tzaddikim who are goyim. That's what I mean. Not among the goyim. I mean Jews among the goyim. I mean who belong to the goyish nation. You don't have that. Throughout the generations, the tzaddikim belong specifically to the Jewish people. Okay.
Such thing as tzaddikim who are goyim?
There could have been, but there could have been had they deserved it. Okay, Marsha says somewhat differently. Marsha says that it's not really disagreeing with each other. Marsha says there's two different psukim over here. One is referring to the tzaddikim of the Jewish people who live, some of them in Eretz Yisrael and some of them in Golos, like you said before. Now, the Gemara is going to talk about, there is such a thing also as tzaddikim among the nations. Okay. Rabbi Yehuda, and in fact, Rabbi Yehuda says, Elu shloshim tzaddikim umas ha'olam, sho umas ha'olam miskayim alei, and this refers to the 30 tzaddikim of members of the nations, which the nations of the world continue to exist in their zchus. So not like we were saying necessarily that there were tzaddikim only among the Jewish people. There were tzaddikim among the goyim too. Ula. Actually, the Gemara is going to say in a second, they have more mitzvahs. Wait. Ula Omar, Ula says, it was shloshim mitzvahs shkibla aleim b'nei noach. The 30 silver coins that we're saying that Hashem says, give me as my reward, refers to the 30 mitzvahs that b'nei noach accepted on them. Now, where do we have 30 mitzvahs? On the face of it, the goyim have seven mitzvahs. Yeah. So you have a couple of lists that are given. You have Rav Shmuel Rav Chofni Goin, who was one of the later Goinim. He was the Mechotin of Rav Shirda Goin, drew up a list of 30 mitzvahs. They're going to be fine in different places. They branch out from the Shev Mitzvahs Bnei Noach. And Rav Menachem Azariah Mifano also, in his Sefer Asorah Ma'amores, gives another list. The two lists are broadly the same, but there are some differences between them. For example, the Gemara talks about in Sanhedrin that Goyim are not allowed to do kishus. You have many different types of kishus. So just like for us Jewish people, they count as separate mitzvahs. Usually we talk about the goyim, they count all under the one basic mitzvah of not to worship Avodah Zarah. But you can break it out. You can break it out also, and therefore that gives you a bunch of extra mitzvahs. You have, for example, goyim are not allowed to kill. Again, usually we would consider that just one mitzvah, the shvichus damim, but you can break it out into a couple of sub things. Don't kill somebody else. Don't commit suicide. The Gemara tells us in Sanhedrin that a goy slaps a Jew on the face, he's chayav mitzvah, so that can also count under shvichus damim, etc. So by working it out like that, you can wind up with 30 mitzvahs. Okay, so obviously those are not keeping the 30 mitzvahs. For one second, there's 30 mitzvahs that they originally accepted. Wait, but v'ein mekayim in ela shloisha. In the event that goyim are only keeping 3 out of those 30 mitzvahs. Achas, number one, she'ein kosvin ksuba l'scharim. Number one is that they don't write ksubas for relationships between males. They do Mishkav Zachar. That's an Aveira, because goyim are not allowed to do Mishkav Zachar. So they violate Mishkav Zachar's homosexuality. So they're not allowed to do that. They're not allowed to have such relationships. That they do. But at least they don't go so far as making it official and writing ksubas for it. So what are we going to say nowadays when they have gay marriage in many countries? You can say they're not keeping that mitzvah anymore very well. But anyway. Yeah. Number two is they don't weigh out the flesh of the dead in the butcher shops. So what does that mean? Rashi says two explanations. One is that we're talking about human flesh. They may well eat it. They may be cannibals, but at least they don't go so far as to weigh it out and sell it in public. That's the second one, that at least they do that. So the first one is, again, that even though they have improper relationships between males, they don't go so far as to legitimize it and make it that, you know, it's an officially legal kind of marriage. Yeah, again, nowadays obviously the goyim are even less moral than they were then.
Are they aware of this?
I have no idea.
I feel like I'm sure they're not.
I have no idea. Probably not. Okay. Number two, again, they may do cannibalism, but at least they have a certain decent respect for it that they don't do it in public. Then Rashi says another explanation that he heard from his Rebbeim. Saramnesa, but he doesn't mean human flesh. It means the flesh of animals that died on their own. So they don't do that. In other words, they may eat such things, but again, they don't weigh it out in the marketplace. Like they don't make a public spectacle that they're eating roadkill or whatever. They will kill an animal somehow.
Not Bosamina Chai.
In other words, but like an animal that just died on its own without some kind of way of killing it. So they may not do shchita like we do, but at least, you know, they shoot it, they electrocute it, they whatever, but they don't. In other words, that's what we're saying. They don't take an animal that's dead, that died on its own, and then weigh it out publicly and eat it.
They take a live animal.
They can use it in private.
They're, in private, maybe they do, but at least they have a certain decency that they don't do that such a thing in public. That's Rashi's second explanation. Okay. And the third one, because they're not allowed to eat Eva Min HaChai, and according to some opinions, they're not allowed to eat Eva Min HaMes either. They have to kill it somehow. That's what we talked about yesterday, actually, in connection with Tvoyach Tevach Lahochim, that Yaakov, that Yosef tells Menashe to prepare an animal, Pralahem Beis HaShchita, and Tosfos says, one explanation, Bnei Yaakov, the Shvatim, were not obligated at that point to actually do Shchita, that's before Matan Torah, but at least they're obligated to make sure that the animal was somehow killed rather than died on its own. So therefore, Yosef is telling Menashe to show them that. So according to that, that's one of the 30 mitzvahs is not to do that.
Yako, who says this?
Yeah, but the point is, according to that way of looking at it, goyim are obligated. But achas shemachabdin at the Torah, and the third one is that the goyim honor the Torah, which actually some of them do. Actually, Rav Moshe Feinstein has an interesting short thing in one of his Chuvas where he says, as a matter of fact, actually, you can see that the Christians are, at least, on Mechabdin of the Torah. You see, they base their whole religion on our Torah. They consider it a tremendous thing when they can bring a proof for one of their Kruma ideas from our Torah. So you see that at least Mechabdin of the Torah in that. Yeah, fine. We're not saying they but at least the Torah should be Chabdin. At least the Torah should be Chabdin.
Every generation, right?
Yeah. Okay, new. Let's go on. Okay.
This isn't part of the Noahide.
No, that's what we're saying. We're talking about that these are mitzvahs. Apparently, that yeah. I mean, that's the thing. In other words, again, you have branches and sub-branches. In other words, again, the same way as, for example, let's say, for example, when it comes to arayis, we know goyim have a mitzvah, have an issur of gilui arayis. It's one of the seven mitzvahs of Minayach. For us Jews, gilui arayis, you have a bunch of different mitzvahs under it. You have each relative is a separate mitzvah. There's a separate mitzvah not to have relations with one's mother and with one's sister and with one's daughter and with one's aunt and so on and so forth. By goyim, they have six relationships which are also the four close relatives plus males with males and people with animals. But all of those, usually we count them only as one mitzvah. We say gilui arayis. But if you break them out, then you have six mitzvahs.
Females with females is
it's not allowed per se, but there's not as much of an issue on it because there can't be any actual, it's called Mishnah Masolus. We'll learn about it in Nidib as Hashem, but yeah. Okay, anyway. All right, let's go on. Getting back to halacha matters now. The Mishnah had said that the issue of Gidanosha does not apply to birds because the Mishnah said they have no calf, the calf being the thigh muscles. What do you mean? Birds have thigh muscles. What do you mean? The answer is islay v'le ogil. Sure, they have thigh muscles, but they're not rounded. They're flat. You can see over here in the picture, you have the cross-section of an animal's thighs are rounded, more or less. The cross-section of a bird's thigh is flat. Like when you pick up a thigh of a chicken to eat it, it's broad and flat. It's not rounded. So therefore, when we say calf, means it has to be rounded. The word calf literally means a spoon, so it has to be shaped like a spoon. And the thigh of a bird is not like that. Boy, Rabbi Yemi, yes, Rabbi Yemi asked, okay, Islay v'oifba ogil, what if you happen to have a bird that has a rounded calf? Islay l'behem v'loy ogil, or what if you happen to have an animal that does not have a rounded calf? My, what would be the din? Basa di deyaz linen, do you go according to the individual bird or the individual animal? Oy basa mineyaz linen, or do you go according to their species as a whole? And the answer is tekel, so therefore we can't be sure. So if you happen to find a bird that has a rounded calf, then you can't eat its gidanosha. But otherwise, in general, you don't have to check. You can assume most birds do not, and you're good. If it happens that you find a bird with a rounded calf that's deformed or whatever and has a rounded calf, then you wouldn't be able to eat its gidanosha because it would be a suffix. Okay, then the Mishnah had said, v'noyeg b'shlil, we said that the din of gidanosha applies to a shlil, to an unborn baby found in the womb. Omar Shmuel, v'chel b'y mutter l'divrei hakol. Now Shmuel said, it's chelev is mutter according to everybody. In other words, the Mishnah had used the expression like this, v'noyeg b'shlil, Rabbi Yehuda, I'm a'ena noyeg b'shlil, v'chel b'y mutter. So we said in the Mishnah that Gid Anosha applies to a Shlil. Rabbi Huda says it does not. And the Mishnah continues, and it's Chaylev is Mutter. So Shmuel is understanding that and it's Chaylev is Mutter is not a continuation of Rabbi Huda's statement. It's according to everybody. So then the question is Chel be Demai. What Chaylev are we talking about that's Mutter according to everybody? Elaim is Shlil. Do you mean that he's talking about the Chaylev of the unborn baby itself, that you found it in the womb, we're saying it doesn't need Shchita, it's a Ben Pekua, we're saying everybody agrees you're allowed to eat a Chaylev? What do you mean everybody agrees? You have, in fact, a Machlokes Tanaim about that. The Tanya, as we learned in the Braisa, we learned before in Perek Behemah HaMaksha, in the fourth Perek, when we had all the Dinim of Ben Pekua over there, we said, Noeg B'Shlil, that the din of Gid Anosha applies to a Shlil, the Chel by Osir, and its Chelav is Osir, just like it would be from a born animal. Divrei Rav Meir, so says Rav Meir, Rabbi Yehuda ain't a Noeg B'Shlil. And Rabbi Yehuda says it doesn't. The Chel by Mutter, and that the Chelav of it is Mutter. So therefore we see Rav Meir holds that the Chelav of it is Osir, and Rabbi Yehuda holds it's Mutter. And the Amar of Allah, the Amar of Oshir, Machloikas, the Ben Tisha Chai, the Holach, the Machloikas is when you have a baby that was in the womb for 9 full months, and then after its mother was shechted, you opened up the womb, you found it over there, and then the Ben Tisha Chai, so you have it was found alive in the womb, the Holach, Rav Meir, the Shitaseh, Rabbi Yehuda, the Shitaseh, so Rav Meir and Rabbi Yehuda are going according to their respective opinions, where Rav Meir had said over there that such a baby requires its own shchita. It's not mutter with its mother's shchita because it's already full grown. And Rabbi Yehuda says it is. So therefore, by the same logic, Rabbi Meir says that its chaylev is also just as if it was already born, because according to him, it's considered a completely separate animal. And Rabbi Yehuda holds that not. So obviously Shmuel cannot mean that everybody agrees that the chaylev is that the chaylev of it is mutter, because Rabbi Meir clearly holds it's not. The El Chelba de Gid. So you're going to say that we're talking not about the chaylev of the baby as a whole, but rather you're talking about the chaylev which is around the Gid Anosha. The problem is also on Miflag Pligiba. But we also find a machlokes about that, whether that chaylev is mutter or not. Never mind even an unborn baby. If we're saying the chelba is mutter, and you're saying it means that the chaylev of the Gid Anosha is mutter, not everybody agrees it's mutter.
Then what are we talking about?
That's what we have to figure out. The Tanya, as we learn in a Braisa, Gid Anosha Machatet Achra B'chomokam Shehu. The Gid Anosha, you have to borrow after it. Machatet means like cut out. You have to borrow after it. Machatet means like dig in. You have to dig in.
Borrow
after it. You have to dig in everywhere you find it. B'chomokam Shehu, wherever you find it. V'choisech Shamna Me'ikre, Divrei Meir. And the Meir says, besides that you have to go and find, get all the branches of the Gid Anosha and remove them, says the Meir. Also, you have to take the entire chaylev of it, mi'ikroi, from its root, meaning everywhere, even where it's embedded into the muscles and everything, you have to remove all that chaylev, says your mayor. Rabbi Yehuda says you don't need to do that. All you need to do is cut it off flush with the shofi. The shofi is the round muscle over there, the calf, which the Gid Anosha passes through, the quadriceps, right? So therefore, all you need to do, he says, is the chaylev that sticks out above the surface of that, so you have to cut it off just because of maris ayin, so it doesn't look like you're eating the Gid Anosha. That's above the surface, in other words, there's parts of
the muscles?
Yeah, you have places where the Gid and the fat around it are embedded into the muscle, and then you have parts where it's above the surface. So Rabbi Yehuda is saying, all you have to do is cut it flush with the surface, just so it doesn't look like you're eating the Gid Anosha and its chaylev. The rest of it, which is inside, the rest of it, which is inside the muscle, would be mutter. Rashi, Tosfos discusses what Rashi means by that. Does Rabbi Yehuda actually mean that the part of the Gid that's embedded within the muscles is actually mutter, and only the part that runs along the surface is osir? Or does he mean the Gid as a whole is osir? But we're talking about the shuman specifically, that the fat that's on the surface, that's above the surface is osir, but the fat that would be embedded more deeply is mutter. Anyway, the point is,
we don't know.
So that's what I'm saying. So it just discusses the different possibilities, what Rashi means by that, and therefore what Rabbi Yehuda means by that. The halacha is not like Rabbi Yehuda anyway. The halacha is like Rabbi Meir. But anyway, the point is that's also right. That the whole Gid is also right. The point being, in other words, that we see that the chaylev of the Gid is actually a matter of machlokes. So what do you mean, Shmuel is saying that the chaylev? So whether we talk about the chaylev of the Shlil, then Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda argue about it. If we're talking about the chaylev of the Gid Anosha, also Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda argue about it. So what does Rabbi Shimon mean? What does Rabbi Shimon mean that everybody? I mean, what does Shmuel mean when he says everybody agrees? The answer is, well, Olam Chelbo did. No, we are, after all, talking about the fat around the did. What it is Umoga Shmuel, the Rav Meir, Mid Rabbanon also. Shmuel will agree that even that according to Rav Meir, it'll be also only the Rabbanon. Both Rav Meir and Rav Yehuda are saying that what's inside the muscles is not also Daraisa. But Rav Meir is saying that what's inside the muscles of the fat is also Drabbanon. And Rav Yehuda will say not even. All you need to do, the whole thing is mutter, and really all you need to do is cut off the part that's above the surface. D'tani, as we learn in a braisa, b'shamnei mutter, we learned before that the fat around the gidanosha is mutter, v'yisroo k'doshim nagu b'yisur. But Jewish people who are holy are noyig to consider it also. So my lav Rav Meir, shouldn't we assume that braisa is according to Rav Meir? Because according to Rav Yehuda, apparently it would be mutter. And we see that even Rav Meir is saying it's only a minhag, it's only midrabanan. So da'ama mutter min atod of also midrabanan. So Rav Meir therefore would say that's mutter on a daraisa level. It's only that Yisroel Kedoshim say it's also. So therefore that would prove that even Rav Meir holds it's not also daraisa. And therefore that would be what Shmuel means, that daraisa, they both agree it's mutter. The answer is no. Not necessarily. Mimai, who says that's the correct explanation? Dilma Rabbi Yehudahi. Maybe that braisa goes according to Rabbi Yehuda. Maybe Rabbi Yehuda is saying midaraisa, all you need to do is cut off from the surface of what's above the surface. But midrabanan, or based on minhag, not midrabanan, but rather based on minhag, you have to take all of it out. Avol Rabbi Meir, midaraisa nami also. But you would argue that according to Rabbi Meir, that fact around the gidanasha is also even daraisa. The answer is loy sakadaydach. You can't think that way. D'tanya, because that Rav Meir would say midaraisa, the fat is also, and Rav Yehuda would say it's also based on minhag. You can't think that. D'tanya, because we learn in a braisa, gidan nosha mechatet achra b'chol makom shehu. The gidan nosha, you have to dig it out, you have to borrow and after it, wherever you find it. V'shamnei mutter, but the fat of it is mutter. Now, man shamatlei de isle chatita, who did we see before, says that you have to dig it out from wherever it branches off into, that's Rav Meir. V'ka'omar shamnei mutter, and yet he's saying the fat is mutter, implying therefore that even Rav Meir would agree that the fat is mutter on a daraisa level, and it's only also because of Dirabanan or because of Minhag Yisrael. So therefore, clearly, Rav Yehuda would disagree with that. Rav Yehuda would say the fat is not even also, Rav Yehuda would hold that the fat is not even also Drabbanan. So again, or maybe it's also because of Minhag, but no more than that.
You cannot say that Rabbi Meir holds it also the Raisa.
Because then the Raisa that says that you have to dig for all branches of the Gidan Osha, but the fat of Mutter wouldn't go like either of them. It wouldn't be like Rav Yehuda or like Rav Meir.
But if it was Doraisa, it couldn't say that?
How could it say that? How could it say that the fat is Mutter? The fat is mutter. You admit
the gita sir.
No,
the fat is mutter.
No, but that's the point. In other words, that that's the point. Therefore, the mayor has to hold daraisa. It is mutter. If we were to say that the mayor holds that daraisa is also, then you can't say shamne mutter even on daraisa level. So by elimination,
could say the gita sir is a shemen is mutter.
No, because we're trying to establish over here that maybe the mayor holds that fat is also daraisa. But if that's the case, then this braisa wouldn't work like Rav Meir. On the other hand, it wouldn't work like Rav Yehuda, because Rav Yehuda doesn't say you have to dig out all the branches of the gidana. Good. So therefore, that demonstrates that Rav Meir agrees that on some level it is mutter, namely midaraisa. Therefore, that proves Shmuel's point that Rav Meir and Rav Yehuda both agree that the fat is mutter daraisa. That is what Shmuel meant, that when he says b'chelbei mutter of our Mishnah is according to everybody. Right. He means he's talking about that both Rav Meir and Rav Yehuda agree that the fat of the Gidanosha is mutter on a daraisa level.
But what's inconsistent to say that the Gid is asur midaraisa and the Shemen is also asur daraisa?
That's fine. You could say that. We thought maybe Rav Meir said that. But if you said that, then you wouldn't have any opinion to attribute this braisa to. We just had a braisa that says that you have to dig out the gidanosha, all of it and all of its branches are also, but the fat is mutter. If you said Rav Meir holds both of them are also daraisa, then the braisa...
There wouldn't
be any opinion that says that. So by elimination, it has to be that that's not what Rav Meir holds. It must be that braisa is like Rav Meir. Rav Meir holds that the gidanosha and all of its branches are also daraisa, but the fat is mutter daraisa.
Okay.